Good afternoon. My name is Ethan Diven, and I'm the host of Thinking Inside the Box, The Gauntlet, the podcast of the Operations Group at the National Training Center here at Fort Irwin, California, as part of NTC's Warrior Chronicles. The Gauntlet drives warfighting by talking to leaders from across our joint force about the crucible of ground combat, leadership, training, and fighting at the crown jewel of our Army. Today, I have the pleasure of sitting down with Major General Christopher R. Norrie, Command Sergeant Major Jonathan Reffer, the command team of the 3rd Infantry Division. Also noteworthy, Major General Norrie was the 25th commander of the operations group here at the National Training Center. Sir and Sergeant Major, the pleasure is ours to host the two of you. Could you please just talk a little bit about kind of who you are and what got you to where we are today?
My name's Chris Norrie. You've already talked about, got some time out there at the National Training Center. The most important thing I'll say all afternoon is that I'm a proud dog-faced soldier here in the 3rd Infantry Division, where we're really focused on quietly forging the future of armor. Here is the hammer of the 18th Airborne Corps.
Thank you, sir. I'm Command Sergeant Major Jonathan Reffer, 3rd ID Division's Arm Major. I've been a dog-faced soldier for about 8 years as a battalion brigade, and then careers as an infantry soldier, but from there to the armor community, sir.
And it's going to be hard not to show my bias as a former dog-faced soldier a couple times as well, but really excited to talk about the transformative way, the innovative training that the 3rd Infantry Division is instituting, and any lessons from how the division has approached that. If you'd like to start us off, sir.
I think the first really interesting discussion is about scale, kind of what mechanized formations uniquely offer to our Army. These are large formations that break other nations. Here in the 18th Airborne Corps, as you know, the 82nd Airborne is the best in the world at airborne operations and joint forcible entries. The 101st is the best in the world at long-range air assault operations. The 10th Mountain is the best at fighting in complex terrain in some of the most austere and remote locations in the world. For us here in 3rd Infantry Division, our goal is to be the best in the world at large-scale ground combat operations. Singular, sole focus is to build the best mechanized formations in the world. And when you think about scale and what that means, what an armor brigade combat team carries, it's equivalent to 5 GBU-43s. As you know, that's the largest non-nuclear weapon that we have in the Department of Defense, and it was used in Afghanistan one time, and here one armor brigade carries the net explosive weight equivalent of 5 of those every day. So these are large formations here. It's the equivalent of having an offensive lineman in the National Football League that's 6 feet 9 inches tall, 435 pounds, and runs a 3.5 40-yard dash. These are big athletes that you want to get up the field into an enemy in close combat. We've been given very clear guidance from the 18th Airborne Corps to extend the duration of our training while at home station, time out in the field, and then also to master combined arms operations at night and then at scale. I'm going to turn it over to Martin Seven to talk about our view of how we win with these formations.
Sir, I think ultimately it comes down to it is that if you look at the format that we've kind of converted to, the training philosophy here in 3rd ID is, you know, going out for a long period of time. The first thing, you build the grit, you fight through a lot of problems, you start seeing, you know, holes in your swings. And then what happens is that you kind of fight through that first 72 hours. And then you kind of get into that, you know, you start setting a good battle rhythm. You start having them healthy habits, maintenance meetings, log stats, log pack. In my eyes here in 3rd ID for the division sergeant major and, you know, the NCOs, it's truly how do you create an environment to build repetitions and actually identify them holes in your gap. And then ultimately, it really ties back to the 8-step training model, you know, that opportunity to do step 8 continues to retrain. So keeping them in a long period of time in the field, you get them reps and sets. And in the end, you start building that cohesion inside the teams to physically start bonding and executing at scale, like the CG says, multiple reps at night. Now I know how to actually maneuver the formation.
The interesting thing, Ethan, is some specific training problems. And there's several that we've talked about. One is the Op4 problem, right? So let's say that you take a unit that's getting evaluated. They have OCs, someone's looking over their shoulder. Those units, sometimes they have issues issuing an order, conducting rehearsals, conducting checks and inspections, LDing on time, etc. You take that same company as an example, that's Blue 4, and then you make them the Op4, and they just start killing stuff, right? At scale, like they're just get after it. One training question is, why is that? And I think that there's an important discussion that we've been having about process versus outcome. That unit that may be being evaluated or kind of going through a set of processes here may feel encumbered. The unit that's the op four, they're singularly focused on an outcome, killing the blue four as an example. So it raises a lot of interesting questions. Do we have the right processes in place? Are we synchronizing the right way? And another interesting conversation we've been having is unlocking an armor brigade combat team. If you think about the scale of what we just talked about and compare it to what I'm assuming you often observe there in the desert, you might have a company that's in contact, a battalion that gets stopped by a single VMP out there. And a lot of times it comes down to some really small unit actions out there, vice that large industrial scale of combat that we're visualizing. One of our thoughts is that right now, given the way we've been training, an armor brigade is a lot like the human brain. We only use about 10% of it at any time. So how do we unlock all of it while in competition? We're also not sure if we view the battlefield correctly. We often visualize through the MDMP process and then a well-orchestrated synchronization matrix, a discrete combination of effects that we'd like to achieve, maybe at one or two places at different times. And that requires a lot of effort to execute. Can we assemble, if you look at capabilities inside an armor brigade combat team, without listing all of them, but pretty quickly you can get to in excess of 20 tanks, Bradleys, Paladins, mortars, rifle squads, scout platoons, human, loitering munitions, one-way attack drones. And if you were just to stack out 20 of those capabilities down the left side of a matrix, and then you just did a binary set of combinations, 20 times 20 equals 400 unique combinations of effects that an armor brigade might possibly assemble against an adversary, but we often find ourselves only talking about a few different places on the battlefield. So a really interesting discussion that me and Sergeant DeReffer have been having is, how do we increase mass at the point of contact, just as a training problem? Intelligence integration, how do we kind of extend national level intelligence down into our formations here? How do we create and hide in clutter? How do we increase mass at the point of contact? Again, more than just two-dimensional fighting, but really extending and increasing the volume. And then the combinations of effects that we're trying to achieve there. How do we hold ourselves accountable in training for achieving our assigned tactical purpose, for achieving an appropriate kill ratio, and then achieving a reasonable rate of advance while in competition? And when we think about the fight, if you just visualize what that first fight might be, we would characterize the pace as being very fast. We believe that confusion absolutely would be the norm. Fundamentals matter. At best, in that kind of close fight there, we might have information parity. Our units must be able to operate on intent. Units must be comfortable operating with degraded communications. There is a ton of clutter on the battlefield. We think that our maneuver risks quickly outpacing our sustainment. Masking and deception matter. Obscuration is critical. The enemy will have great capacity to mass and will likely use chemical munitions. We'll likely, in competition, find friendly units intermingled. And then, like Sergeant Major talked about, I think we'll conclude that grit matters, that we'll frequently have units fighting with less than 50% of their combat power. So the training model that Sergeant Major Reffer just highlighted there, I'm just going to turn it over to him to just talk more about the approach, at least here. Again, just trying to change how we think about training and how we organize, ideally to produce a better training outcome.
Yes, sir. So, I mean, of course, your history here at Third ID, you know a lot of the stuff that we've kind of incorporated. But since you left, there's a lot of things like, you know, it really starts in the morning time. You know, that physical fitness, you can do that right. You can get a lot of things done throughout the day. That's where that team starts forming together. They start bonding and they start working together. The thing we have here is the APEX. The APEX is a very unique program that's really, we've seen huge benefits. not just in our physical aspect, but also with inside our training ability with stress chutes. So we created stress chutes, and these are not your stress chutes that you see in the light infantry world where you go out there with your M4 and you do stress chutes. This is using Bradleys and tanks and incorporating that physical aspect into the range where you take them to a range, you don't give them any idea, they show up. You get them off their platforms, you start putting them through a physical activity, raise that heart rate, make the brain start thinking, and then make them load ammo, move into a BP, and then expose targets. Start squelching radios, start causing clutter on the battlefield, that it's not like a regular table six where a target comes up, I engage. Creating that environment when they're the first time in contact isn't the first time they're in contact. They're getting a rep and set with the stress chute. And then the other thing we've also added into this process is the roll-on, roll-off ranges we've just initiated, where we're focused on really the small arms all the way from 9mm all the way to 249. In April here, April 21st, we're now going to initiate the roll-on, roll-off ranges with Bradleys and tanks. So now our platform is going to be machine gun. It's not going to be main gun. But if you look at the new gunnery tables that we have identified that we've shot here multiple times along with Raider Brigade and now Spartan Brigade has done it twice, we're seeing that the machine gun engagements are the more challenging. So instead of parking these vehicles in the motor pool and then waiting for the next gun line to get out there and get after that lethality, but how do we continuously build lethality in our formations by getting creative, by utilizing the ranges that we have within our installation? And then the long duration, you know, that's something that we've kind of all talked about, comes from more of a legal format, gold cycles at old installations, putting them in a field, field craft, focusing on them warfighting skills, shoot, move, communicate, treat, survive, becoming very brilliant at the basics and able to apply them at an environment where you can scale that up based off where they are in the training model. If you just focus on them standard six things, it's easy to scale from at the lowest level to all the way to a combined arms breach. It's all part of the same fundamentals. And then just ultimately increasing force on force, more reps, and then the fighting NCO. You heard me say fighting NCO a lot, and that's really, what does that mean? That means I understand that sustainment is important in the NCO's mindset. That's where we are. But we also have to understand that there is people that own the rear area. Hold them accountable to facilitate the rear area assets to move forward. We need our NCOs fighting the current fight to allow our officers and our leaders to develop the deep fight to actually be able to pass that on when we get to that part of the phase. And then you heard me out there, as Stand 2 is very dear to my heart, because I think Stand 2 is the alarm clock to the morning. That gets you started with your priorities of work, and you start generating them things that get your soldiers moving in the right direction. And I'll pause there, sir.
It sounds like Third ID has done a lot of thinking and then taking your experiences and developed a hypothesis that has resulted in this unique approach. And sir, what you mentioned, and Sergeant, you as well, a training philosophy, a different way to look at how we are not just training units, but probably also evaluating ourselves. There's got to be data that we're collecting that is a little bit different than what we have done in the past. Some of the feedback that both of you provided, you know, how do we increase mass at points of contact, hiding in clutter? These are things we at the National Training Center try to coach units to do better, but it sounds like you're incorporating at home station. Would you agree this is a unique and novel approach to training? And then second, are there specific data points that were most important to you, and any initial thoughts on those?
One thought is that the way that we've been training may not be producing the right kinds of formations. In other words, when you look at the National Training Center, there's a set of problems out there that have just been stubborn. I'm not saying that you largely, before a rotation can start, with a degree of accuracy can predict what the major trends will be, but there's certainly been stability in the observation over the years. And so the challenge that we've talked about is the world is changing in front of us, and we continue to look back at a stubborn set of problems: size of our command posts, quality of orders, rehearsals. And so our thought was, hey, we got to fix that. We got to solve these stubborn problems so that we can turn our formations into being more forward-looking, just kind of commensurate, that we can change at the pace with which we're observing that change in the world. When you look at the training model, and we learned this from Raider when they were out there at the National Training Center, there are some challenges with what we would characterize as short-duration training. So if you look at how we've trained for the last several years, We'll send a battalion out to gunnery for 10 days or 14 days. We'll bring them in for a few weeks, and then we'll send them back out for another period of time, bring them in, move them out. That creates a lot of stress at the brigade and installation level. And then the units are always in some form of transition, right? Where they're in training, recovering, and prepping to go to the next kind of training event. What Sergeant Reffer talked about, it's kind of what's old is new. Spartan Brigade here, they just went to the field for 6 straight weeks, all of them, the entire brigade. They did not come in. They were green for training. They had no taskings on the installation. They were all out in the field, and they owned the entire training area, all of Fort Stewart. And that was the BSA and the SSA, just like they were deploying somewhere. Well, our thought was that under the old training model, first, you can fake sustainment, right? Just fix it when it gets back to the motor pool, when gunnery's over. Your command posts normally don't go out until the end of the training cycle, so they might get 10 to 14 days at the end, and we wonder, hey, why can't they communicate when they arrive at the National Training Center? That brigade got 45 days of reps every day. Every command post was out there. They got 45 days of correctly distributing supplies via Alpha Company. The BSA jumped multiple times. The command post jumped. They practiced clutter. All of those things there, practicing at scale. Again, that large group of activities required for an ABCT to maximize its lethality needs a lot of practice. The longer duration, you can't fake sustainment. It's all got to work. And after a few weeks out there, things started to settle, and we had a good set of training outcomes from a sustainment standpoint. The command post, 6 straight weeks, multiple CUAs, battle rhythm events, command post exercises, etc., and then a lot of practice here in 18th Airborne Corps, the majority of the repetitions fighting at night. At the end of that 6-week period, that is a good unit. They are salty. The command posts are working. Sustainment is happening. We watched a brigade level force on force, and they weren't faking it. Sometimes you see units that are fighting at night, but bumper to bumper, they were actually reacting to contact in the same way they would in full daylight. They were moving comfortably out there. The third interesting thing, if you go in and out, every time you go back out, it takes a couple of days to get reoriented to the training. When you just put them out for 6 weeks, they arrived at each gate much more ready to train. We have focused on training objectives, specific, measurable, achievable, relevant, and timely, there to hold ourselves accountable and to monitor our progress relative to a set of home station training objectives, and then did a ton of stuff with UAS and dropping chalk and practicing loitering munitions, all the innovations.
I am particularly interested in the role of the non-commissioned officer and the growth we probably saw as units got salty and we weren't, as General Norrie said, training for a little bit and then coming back in and then restarting, slow start to get back to where we were.
I think the biggest thing I saw from the NCO Corps was they saw their weaknesses early in the process and they knew they had 6 weeks to refine that training plan. So, you know, you think about it, like we published a new policy letter where you're not allowed to be on the hardballs anymore. So we forced them back into the tank trails. In that policy, you have to drive under NDGs. There's no white light, except there's risk or some type of thing that a commander determines. What we saw at the beginning was they tried to scale up, and NCO stepped in and said, hey, we are not at the level we need to be at, and we can peel it back, and we're going to go white light for the next couple of days to recertify, revalidate, ensure that our leaders understand expectations on what we want to achieve at the end. I think truly, as we watch the NCOs mature over time, a lot of the sergeant majors pulled themselves to the point of friction. It isn't the point of friction where they're comfortable at. That 6 weeks, they got to understand their commander and where the commander's thought they needed to be on the battlefield. And I think at a CTC's, you see sergeant major struggle with that. It's not till probably about day 6 that sergeant major is now like, okay, I understand what my commander's problems are. I'm going to move there. So I think what you saw was over the 6 weeks, NCOs started understanding how they can actually help their commander to see the battlefield and also move to them points to continuously move the ball forward, because in our mind says we own the current fight. So the current friction point should be led by an NCO. So I think what you saw at the end of that combined arms breach in Five Corners there in Fort Stewart, PLS is moving under MVGs at a safe pace. You saw the growth. It's the first time in my time here at Third Idea I saw a transmission slung load slung by a 48, a 47 to a UMCP, which validates the purpose why we have cabs in our armor formation. We wouldn't have done that before. We would have just waited to either drag that thing out on a log pack. Getting creative and understanding how the whole BCT is actually operates, we got to actually do that. I think it's also, it's the way we have to fight, because our lexicon, how we communicate in 18th Airborne Corps, we communicate to light formations. We're the only heavy formation able to communicate with the people we're going to fight on the battlefield with inside the 18th Airborne Corps. Is we have to talk the same way that our light infantry understands how they can employ to achieve the end state that our commanders want.
And so just to read back, what I think I just heard, Sergeant Major, is 3rd Infantry Division has reestablished the role of the non-commissioned officer, especially while training large-scale combat operations. What we observe here at NTC is just like you described, there's usually a gap where a senior enlisted leader, whether it's a first sergeant or command sergeant major, doesn't necessarily know where that point of friction is. And unless there's that conversation, it can take a little while. And what the NCO Corps of 3rd ID, better, stronger, forged relationship with commanders and moving to and owning the current operations fight, I think that's a really powerful way to describe it. Would you say that through Spartan and really Raider's experiences, and I'm sure all the multifunctional brigades, that the division has validated the role of a heavy and a mechanized formation inside the 18th Airborne Corps, really said this is what we do as the hammer of the 18th Airborne Corps?
Again, the discussion that we have as we communicate here inside 18th Airborne Corps is what we talked about up front, what we uniquely offer. We offer scale. We can extend direct fire. We can sustain at scale, mission command at scale. We can provide fires at scale. We provide, again, just a large formation here that fills kind of that large scale ground combat operations need that we have in our Army here. We have enjoyed in 18th Airborne Corps, we've got such great relationships with the 82nd and 101st and 10th Mountain. As you know, we routinely do heavy light rotations down at the Joint Readiness Training Center. And we've got a company down there right now that's in the box with 2nd Brigade of the 82nd. We also are working really hard to rebuild our deployment DNA here. And so we have an immediate response package. It's a Bradley platoon plus mission command plus sustainment. And in the last year, we've flown it out 7 total times. We've done different tabletop exercises. We had a mechanized formation integrate with 2nd Brigade, 82nd Airborne at Fort Bragg. So we flew a mechanized unit up there and they trained with the 82nd there in their training area. And so we are looking for multiple opportunities, first to articulate the value of these formations and what they uniquely offer, and then to create opportunities where we can train and continue to build those teams. Here, flew that immediate response package out to the National Training Center with Raider. And the other thing is we're learning a lot from these divisions, these transform and contact brigades that are inside 18th Airborne Corps. Jim Stultz from 2nd Brigade, 101st, when he went to JRTC, he had a main brigade main command post that was 4 Humvees and a tent. Jim Armstrong, when he went out there with Raider, he had a brigade command post that was 4 AMPVs and a tent. We're building drones here, looking at creating our own clutter through our innovation center, building electromagnetic decoys, using some of our legacy systems and other things to invest in deception on the battlefield so we can create a clutter, move to a different part of the spectrum, hide in a place that an adversary might not expect our formations to be, and then fight from there. It's a really good question. How do we add value? How do we create opportunities? And then how do we evolve? While we were in Europe, changing how we think, kind of our headwear versus our hardware there, we are creating those opportunities, looking to demonstrate the value that we add, and then also creating a framework that really focuses on how we think. Sarmaj Refer has been brilliant at that. I'll turn it over to you for your thoughts on kind of some of the innovations and opportunities we have here in AT114.
I mean, I think you understand our innovation lab is probably, I would say it's the most revolving and probably developed one in the, definitely in our core. I don't know about the other cores. I think it's really neat is how does the NCO fit into TIC? I think that's a really big question a lot of people ask. I think it starts with innovation. Our NCOs are the ones that kind of create the innovation. They're the ones that are the grassroots of the process. They see the problem. They deal with the problem on a daily basis. So they start getting collaborating with their soldiers. We're finding credible talent inside our formation. And it's not coming from a person that graduated from a college or went to school for something. It's truly E1s, E4s. Problems like, hey, it costs so much to get a mannequin to pump blood through. So we just 3D printed a whole arm and then put silicone packing devices in it and then just pumped Kool-Aid through it. So now we can replicate that massive trauma to a wound that they now can pack it. They can put a tourniquet on it. That's not being created by, you know, the hospital. That's being created by some infantry soldier that says, hey, I need to do some more medical training. I want to train how I'm going to experience something in real life. Inside the TIC world, that's how I see our role as an NCO is how do we see them small, stubborn problems and create a solution to fix it or build a solution to train on it. So when we are put in that situation, we have the reps and sets to be successful.
So, Sarmaj, you talked about expectation that junior infantry soldier, not a college graduate that has been uniquely trained to do that. How is that changing your leadership development approach inside 3rd Infantry Division? Because it sounds like we've got an innovative approach to our training philosophy. We're encouraging innovation. Is that changing the way you're pushing all leaders to be developed?
Really, sir, older NCOs is to, you got to understand your formation. You got to understand where people come from and what they've done before they joined the Army. The Army's definitely transitioned since I joined the Army in 97. Either went to college or we joined the military. I think overall, the message from me down to our NCOs is, why don't you take a second and allow people to explain to them what the problem is? And they might actually have the solution. You might not be the smartest person in the room, and you need to collaborate as a team and try to achieve the end state that's going to, you know, create survivability or create an opportunity to address a problem. We introduced that innovation lab early in the process. When you in-process 3rd ID, you were at the community fair, and we're now capturing friction points from other installations as they show up and say, hey, when I was at X duty station, we had this problem. They take that problem back to the innovation lab, and we try to solve them problems, not at mass, but at a scale that we can at least try to get it to a point if it's something we want to pass on to Futures Command or industry.
And I'm hearing the message loud and clear. It's the balance of being brilliant at the basics, but also encouraging innovation from as soon as you get a new dog-faced soldier. Does that change how you say, leaders, I expect you to at the battalion, brigade, or company battery troop level?
My message is pretty clear to all the NCOs. You know, be brilliant, basis, and that's simple. PT every morning, shoot, move, communicate, treat, and survive. Innovate in them six things. I think to achieve the General Norrie's guidance is innovation, people, and warfighting. You know me for a long time. I don't create big things. I think it's just truly just do what the Army asks us to do and be brilliant at what your job is. If you're a rifleman, be the best rifleman in your team. If you're the supply clerk, be the best supply sergeant in that company. Guess what? You're competing against yourself because you're the only supply sergeant in there. So if supplies are not achieving the end state, then you're failing at your job and you just need to continue to compete against yourself.
You know, it's interesting. We have told units what they won't do. Don't progress to the next level of training until you've mastered what Sarmaj Refer talked about, your own set of fundamentals. This unit, Spartan, that we just had out in the field, we told them, if you just do driver's training for 6 weeks, hey, roger out, we're good. If you just do gunnery for 6 straight weeks, that's great. But get the right foundation before you progress through the collective training. There's a mindset change, right? We want to finish everything that we had on the calendar, but giving leaders permission to get that foundation right is really important. What I observed, and again, I've got 49 rotations out there, 49 times 7 fights a rotation, 330 or so brigade level fights. What I observed here at Fort Stewart, after that unit had been out there for 6 straight weeks, at least matched anything I observed in the desert in any of those fights. The only way they got to that point was because they insisted on getting the fundamentals right, conducting retraining and creating repetitions and opportunities for them to get all of the right kinds of healthy habits that we would hope for in our large armor brigade combat teams. Conducting stand-to, correctly doing maintenance, conducting maintenance meetings, correctly doing orders and conducting rehearsals, doing all of those things correctly, giving them time to actually do it, just giving them permission to stay if they weren't ready to progress, to continue there until they were comfortable and then progressing. They would not have gotten to that end without that insistence on getting the fundamentals correct.
See, at the end of the day, too, it started at the beginning. So they treated it as a mission. They staged in their motor pools. They would roll out of a FOB or a FOSS, verb, or even in RUBA. They uncoiled as a brigade. They controlled that movement. They did all their movements. They did the exercise. When they redeployed, they treated it almost like a passage of lines. They redeployed back to Sparta. It wasn't, hey, we culminated. Their minds were so programmed to be operating in that environment. So they actually, you know, the first couple of days was a little rough. Got to get rained on before you can say you're in the field. The switch gets turned on and it's like, okay, let's get after this. And then you saw that switch happen. You think about it too, on the other aspect is, it's also a rep for our families. Training Mile don't give a rep to the families. You can funk issues for a whole week at home. You can't funk them for 6 weeks. Family members started to understand how to operate on their own. I need to know how to do this. So now when they come back in, there's a good conversation on like, hey, when you go to the NTC, where that first rep is in that training model, where you're taking soldiers away from their family members for a long period of time, they got that rep already. We understand what it means when I go to the field for 4 weeks, 6 weeks, so forth.
With the identification of the SMART training objectives and generating a training outcome that it sounds like 3rd Infantry Division Spartan Brigade are very proud of, is this changing what you are collecting as far as readiness data or things that you are bringing in and you want reported to comment or provide assessments on where units are and their proficiency in any way based on what Spartan just did and 3rd ID has created?
First, the SMART training objectives allow you to really kind of time everything out. Length of fire mission, quality of order. So there's a level of granularity through which we can hold ourselves accountable simply by thinking about what our desired training outcome is before we go out, and then comparing our performance against the desired end state throughout the training there. Back to the process versus outcome discussion. One thing that we're very interested in is, did our units or can our units achieve their tactical task that they were given? That is the equivalent of counting a win or loss kind of overall. One thought is that if we don't do that, then the only thing left is the process, you know? And so kind of skewing towards a process because we're not providing them feedback, you won that fight or you clearly lost that fight. And that creates another kind of encourages competition there. But it also forces a unit, if the sync matrix isn't working, then maybe we should think about all of that differently. So it allows us to focus on outcome too. So you've got the objectives that are the SMART objectives, a set of kind of an outcomes focused approach. And then the other two are super interesting. Very simply, are we killing more of the enemy than is killing us? The American people invest a tremendous amount of resources in our formations. It is reasonable for them to expect us to be able to do that. And then also continuing to advance while in competition, not getting scared of our shadow by a BMP in the Central Corridor, but continuing to fight through contact. And so that's just kind of some thoughts on the objectives and what we're hoping to achieve.
That's an incredibly insightful and interesting, also probably a commander to set a bar and then get measurable feedback and applying it to potentially a CTC rotation, either turn up or turn down, conditions of the environment or variables that the opposing force can influence. I appreciate the dichotomy of the conversation. It is about what, you know, Spartan and 3rd Infantry Division is experiencing, but potential influence the way we look at things here at the National Training Center. So what are you doing with all of this that you have observed? Are you capturing it in an after-action review, planning on sharing it, of course, with fellow divisions, to the Corps, to the CAC? What is the next step?
The most powerful and important thing that we're doing is going on this podcast. We're writing about it. We'll talk about it. We're sharing it across Forces Command. We've learned and we'll continue to focus on it here. Now, I think there's a few other just kind of interesting outcomes. One is, how do we coach or talk to our brigade and battalion level command teams? So I think issuing orders, that's something we can practice every day while we're in garrison, so that you don't have, while you're in the field, an entire huge formation waiting on the order. They have the intent, they know where they're going. We have efficient planning and rehearsals processes there. That's an important focus area. Counter UAS, we really have to look at that at scale. And Sergeant Reffer's got some incredible thoughts about UAS, the types of UAS, and how to integrate it. Another interesting is, what is the brigade commander's fight? Focusing where the brigade can, where the battalions can here. Also, how do leaders position themselves and how do they visualize in this fight? I do think that we have an inclination to overthink some of this, kind of in pursuit of the exquisite command post or the exquisite mission command system. Our thought, after observing these units in contact, you got a battalion commander or even a brigade commander that's in a position where they can observe the battlefield. They can talk. They've got their FSO. They've got their S2. They've got their fighting products, a really good sit temp, event temp, a synchronization matrix, operational graphics, and a DSM, an FM radio. They're good, right? We don't need to overthink this. They're in contact out there. And so just understanding kind of where to visualize and then being comfortable visualizing organically with the tools that you have, where you are on the battlefield, and then focusing on common operating pictures, ensuring that they have a common vantage point, good CCIR, a good set of graphics there, and a good overall common operating picture. And then for the battalion level, good healthy habits, stand to maintenance rehearsals, and just a focus on the fundamentals. Sergeant Reffer's got a lot of thoughts on the sergeant's major, and I do want to just kind of as an output of the training here.
I think the brigade sergeant majors are learning is, like General Norrie said earlier, you know, what's old is new, is thinking back to what does large-scale combat operation mean for the NCO, getting back to the basics. What does stand to mean to a young E5 that's never done it? What it's creating is creating really great opportunities to get after hip pocket training, focusing on good load plans. As we do this, the brigade sergeant major is, I'm not saying he's not relevant, but he becomes more relevant into the operational current fight aspect. Because as we look at it, you read a lot, they run sustainment. Okay, if I don't have casualties, I don't need you at the role too. Because we've created this environment that we think, hey, that's where that individual needs to be. Really how I coach it is like, hey, if you need to be there, go back and check on it. But you also need to come back up to the flot and ensure that our junior NCOs and our platoon sergeants and squad leaders are doing the right thing. So don't disconnect yourself because you've been told, hey, the sustainment is the NCO fight. That is a portion of it. I think how our brigade sergeant majors view it now more of is that is a portion of the fight, but there is someone in charge of that area. I'm going to pressurize that person to do their job, to provide the resources to the flot to ensure that stuff gets forward instead of the rogue sergeant major that's running from the front line all the way to the rear area to get the one wiring harness that's going to get up X vehicle. And they get there, they put it in, and they high-five each other like they've just solved world hunger. That's not very good way to use your time. Ultimately, when you do them things, you break the system of record. It's not captured in some type of maintenance meeting, log stat. It's not assumed right. We think we're doing the right thing, and we think we're helping our organization, but ultimately, I think we're hindering our organization because we're not following the proper procedures to actually achieve the end state with them procedures.
I really like what you said, Sergeant Major. It's the command sergeant major is a precision guided munition that if put to check the checker, to get results at that point of friction, to not do it themselves, but lead through whatever leader is responsible for that system, that process, or that task. I love it because we observe it, you know, every rotation, and we try to coach the conversation with the commander and then go drive action, but not personally. You're an organizational leader now. Who are you leading through?
I think also the other thing is we could also work on it. We try to do it here. Sometimes you don't have to speak. You can watch and you can receive body language from your commander where that individual, you can see where Colonel Diven is frustrated. And I would tell you that is probably the point of friction that you need to go to. Where your commander has concerns or nervous about it, that would be the best advice I could tell a Sergeant Major is go to that point because your commander is concerned about that. Solve that problem. Report back up telling your commander you achieved the end state that you want to achieve and find out where else you need to go. I think sometimes we like to just want to talk the whole time and just being a quiet professional, sitting, watching, listening, and seeing body language. I think it also can tell you where you need to be on the battlefield.
Sergeant Major, thank you. So to Marn 6 and Marn 7, I want to give kind of both of you an opportunity for any kind of final comments or what you're taking away, what you want the force, our leaders, to know about the training innovation, the approach, and what the dog-faced soldiers of the 3rd Infantry Division, the Rock of the Marne, are doing.
Listen, this idea of kind of quietly forging the future of armor, uniquely positioned here as the hammer of the 18th Airborne Corps, is driving a tremendous amount of innovation. Transforming in contact is changing the Army. Tomorrow, it's changing it today. It's also changing it across formations here. I think it's important. We have got to solve those stubborn problems so that we can stay focused as the world changes in front of us here. We've got to be better at providing that industrial scale sized killing machine, always ready to express the will of the American people on anyone that would dare harm our way of life or our national interest here. It's a sacred responsibility. I'm proud to be here on this team, pursuing that, doing what we can to make things better. I'm also profoundly proud to talk to you here, just given everything that the National Training Center means, not only to our formations, but to our Army as the crown jewel of our Army out there. So thank you for the opportunity. We're very proud to have had a chance to talk to you, and I'll turn it over to Sergeant Major Rufford.
To the NCO Corps, win the small wins. Focus on the small wins. That's simple things as just doing good PT every morning, packing your rucksack, doing good weapons maintenance, owning your equipment when the nation calls or you have to go to the field. That's how you help your commander. We should always be ready to fight at moment notice. I mean, it's a 24-hour, 7-day job. And, you know, ultimately, we play a contact sport, but that contact sport's not football. It involves two human beings and a bullet. I think the little wins is what will achieve the big wins. That's my advice. Just be the best job you're supposed to be. If you're the first sergeant of a company, be the best first sergeant of that company. Focus on the basics, but the basics to me is, you know, the little wins lead to big wins, and that's what makes you successful on the battlefield.
Thank you, General Norrie, Sergeant Major Rufford. It's been exciting. Exceptional insights. It is clear that you are bearing the responsibility of leading an American's Contingency Corps as the hammer of the 18th Airborne Corps. I am super excited to see the continued outputs as the rest of our Army and our leaders are. Hey, how you're going to drive innovation, help us train better, which ultimately will help us fight better. As always, regardless of if you're here in the dirt in the High Mojave at our Crown Jewel or distributed, our Observer Coach trainers are always here on your team because this is your training center. And for all our listeners, invite you to look at our Mill Suite pages, latest products, subscribe to TAC Talks on YouTube for any quick hitting lessons and products. Thanks for listening to Thinking Inside the Box, The Gauntlet, part of the NTC's Warrior Chronicles. Have a great rest of your day. Rock of the Marne.
Rock of the Marne.